This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're starting off the new year with an evolving public health issue. Flu season is in full swing, and it's expected to be a rough one. As many as 46 states are reporting widespread cases of flu. Nationally, more than 100 people have died from flu, and we're only just getting into the season.
Oh, that is rough, and California has been hit especially hard, according to an analysis in Kaiser Health News. They're seeing a record high number of hospitalizations with the flu. They're having a hard time keeping up with the number of cases that actually require hospital care. But we're seeing that story played out all across the country, and state health officials are on notice and letting the public know.
And, you know, Margaret, there are several factors at play. This year's flu strain is a particularly virulent one. And according to public health officials, the vaccine for the flu proved to be only about 10% effective in preventing flu, according to data compiled from Australia's flu season.
But we have to reiterate what we know from decades of experience. People are still far better off getting the flu shot. The evidence is clear. Even if it doesn't fully protect you from contracting the flu, the vaccine can diminish the severity of a case of flu. And that is so important when we look at flu mortality data, especially with the elderly and children, but really for all ages. It's a public health axiom that bears repeating. The more people who are vaccinated, the less likely it is to spread through the population.
That's a great point, Margaret. And speaking of public health, our guest today is a state leader who is quite committed to health and the well-being of his constituents. Governor John Hickenlooper of Colorado is joining us today, talking about the state's commitment to improving public health through a variety of state-based programs. Really looking forward to having him on our show today.
He'll also be talking about what they've learned from their grand experiment as the first state in the nation that legalized recreational marijuana and what they think other states can learn from their experience.
We'll also have Lori Robertson stop by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org, looking at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Governor John Hickenlooper of Colorado in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Congress is moving ahead with approval of the president's pick to run the Department of Health and Human Services, replacing former HHS Secretary Tom Price, who resigned last year. Former insurance industry executive Alex Azar came before the Senate Finance Committee to respond to a number of questions about the healthcare industry, including the high cost of drug prices. He said he'd be willing to look at ways to bring prices under control, but that a new formulary would have to be required to do this effectively across the board. He also noted it might be worth a look to see if Medicaid could be shifted from a so-called entitlement program to a block grant system, offering states more flexibility. New Hampshire is moving closer to legalizing recreational marijuana. The state house passed a measure that would allow people over 21 to grow up to 3 pot plants on their own for personal use. It would not allow for the sale of marijuana at retail outlets. This follows on the heels of neighboring Vermont, who just passed a similar measure in that state, with Republican Governor Rick Scott expected to sign it. There has been some evidence that availability of legal pot has actually exerted a downward pressure on reliance on opioids. Both states have seen a dramatic effect from the opioid crisis. Meanwhile, states are bracing for what might come next in the wake of the announcement from the Justice Department that the feds would now begin cracking down on states who defy federal marijuana laws. The Trump administration's anti-cannabis move was also roundly slammed by dozens of members of Congress from both parties. From pot to nukes. The CDC is holding talks later this month on how public health officials and individuals should prepare for nuclear war. The CDC saying that while the chance for a nuclear explosion isn't certain, preparation and planning can, quote, lessen deaths and illness in the wake of such an event. Others are expressing deep concern. Former Vice President Joe Biden stating he thinks the U.S. has never been closer to the threat of nuclear war. And the U.S. is losing significant ground in one area, research. Long the dominant player in research protocols and breakthroughs around the globe, Protocols funded by the National Institutes of Health, largely, the U.S. no longer holds the top spot in randomized control trials. For the first time, Canada and most of the European nations have taken the lead in randomized trials by surgeons. The U.S. has seen a steady decline in recent years in approved research funding, leading to studies being interrupted or unfunded and the loss of ability to attract talented researchers from around the world. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Governor John Hickenlooper, the 42nd governor of the state of Colorado, serving since 2011, a geologist, entrepreneur, longtime advocate for community health center movement. Governor Hickenlooper previously served as mayor of Denver and was chosen by Time magazine as one of the top five big city mayors in the country. Governor Hickenlooper chaired the National Governors Association and has since led a bipartisan coalition of governors committed to preserving the Affordable Care Act. He was named as one of Esquire magazine's Americans of the Year, and he's author of the 2016 memoir, The Opposite of Woe. Governor Hickenlooper earned his BA in literature, his MS in geology from Wesleyan University. Governor Hickenlooper, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, it's so exciting to be on, and thank you for all the work you guys have done.
Well, and speaking of great work, certainly Colorado is known as one of the healthiest states in the nation, and certainly your work as governor played an essential role in establishing policies that promote health and well-being across the entire state. And you've served both as governor and the mayor of Colorado's largest city. You focused in on a full scope of determinants of health, from enrollment and health coverage to access to care, environmental quality, public transportation as well. And you took on the task of homelessness at the city of Denver. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners, based on your own personal experiences, what you think are the most important health issues that a state leader needs to be focused in on right now.
Well, I think the integration, and as you were listing all those various initiatives, the integration of how we make sure that everybody has a medical home, and that that medical home, by its nature, should include mental health, so people can really kind of one-stop shop, where they know they're going to get care, and if they need specialty works, they could get recommended to one place or another. That's probably, to me, the highest priority. And basically, that's a way of expanding coverage without letting your costs run wild and without compromising in any way your quality. I mean, expanded coverage at the same cost or minimal increased cost, maintaining and improving quality, that's got to be the North Star for everybody.
Well, Governor Hickenlooper, we really appreciate your looking at healthcare and primary care particularly as that North Star, and yet we've all seen over our long years in healthcare that without coverage, access to really good healthcare can be very problematic for people. And it's been really remarkable under the Affordable Care Act over these recent years to see coverage expand to more than 20 million Americans who were uninsured before. And I know that you've seen significant coverage gains in your state as well. What have those gains in coverage meant to the people of your state, and how have they impacted population health over these past couple of years?
Well, we've always been the thinnest state. I mean, Colorado, you know, we're the highest state. I'm not talking about medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, but we have the most elevation of any state. So a lot of people are attracted here for hiking and mountain biking and skiing, you know, outdoor recreation. So we've always been the thinnest state, but we haven't always been the healthiest state. And I think a lot of that is we had never tasked ourselves to say, how do we expand coverage? Because that's a big part of it. I think that healthcare, in a funny way, is like that old cliche of a chain. And a state can only be as strong as its weakest link. Hmm. And through the Affordable Care Act, we ended up expanding coverage to about 600,000 people in a state with 5.5 million residents. So that's more than 10%. Right. We really went from about 15% people that were not covered down to less than 5%. That's when you can really begin talking about becoming one of the healthiest states.
Governor, as you were talking about how you had expanded coverage, I was thinking about the funding of health programs like CHIP and Medicaid. the major challenges for state executives and the funding for programs like community health centers and the National Health Service Corps, all vital to the delivery system that you have in Colorado and states have across the country. But in Washington, there's this ongoing battle over how to fund these programs that impact state budgets very significantly. So how are you and other governors dealing with this uncertainty in federal health care funding?
Well, you know, there's a bunch of us, Republicans and Democrats, have been working on, you know, everything from trying to protect the Affordable Care Act to CHIP is the more recent political bargaining chip that Congress always wants to, hey, if you give me this, I get that. Again, CHIP should never, it's always been bipartisan. It should have nothing to do with politics. I think that the whole country has moved dramatically forward. This notion, you know, in Colorado, I know you guys have a great community health center network in Connecticut, but I like to think that the first community health center network was the Denver Health has a system of clinics. I think that having clinics where everyone is received and you have some sort of sliding scale, that is the only future that I can see foreseeable that is going to allow us to really ultimately get eventually 100% coverage and yet still make sure that we're not taking away too much of our public resources from higher ed, K-12 education, you know, all the other pressing needs.
Well, you know, Governor Hickenlooper, among the many provisions of the Affordable Care Act, one of the important chapters was on innovation and how to foster innovation at the state level. And that's something that you and your team in Colorado seem to have really excelled at. You've got your Colorado State Innovation Model, or SIM as it's known, with a number of pilots, I think, have kind of moved on from the pilot stage now to improve care, improve outcomes, really transform healthcare. You talked about integrating behavioral health into primary care, which is so critical, but also making payment reforms based on the outcomes that patients experience and other value-based initiatives. We'd love for you to share with us what some of the SIM innovations are that you've developed in Colorado and share with us some of those lessons.
Yeah, when we first applied for a federal grant, the focus was how do we really integrate mental health into people's existing medical homes where they can go and get primary care. And that SIM program has been remarkably successful. I was just down in a clinic in Southern Colorado, and it has changed the way they approach delivering health care of not just mental health, but everything, so that they will have a team approach, and in one group meeting they will have, you know, four or five or six different professionals that will go down the list of all these different patients who are, each one is unique, yep. And yet they can find the generalities and the opportunities to catch undetected threats and make sure that they're addressed very early on. When I talked to every single professional in this clinic, everyone, they couldn't stop raving about it. And almost to a person, they said they were working longer hours, but loving it more. Nobody wants to work more hours and not get paid, but they were totally enthusiastic. And I think those kinds of innovations, we've really worked hard to try and give people taking care of their own health. And for all our state employees, we have an incentive program so that if someone's smoking, we make sure that there's dollars and cents involved in their quitting smoking, because we know that ultimately that's going to make them a better employee, a better investment, but it's also going to save the healthcare system cost.
We're speaking today with Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. He served as chairman of the National Governors Association, and before that was mayor of Denver. Governor Hickenlooper, I think it's almost axiomatic when we hear your name to think of sort of a bipartisan approach, including in the area of health policy. And you and Republican Governor John Kasich have notably launched several bipartisan efforts on a variety of topics, urging lawmakers in Washington to improve the Affordable Care Act rather than repeal it. And you've also both recently demanded the reauthorization, as you've just mentioned, of the CHIP funding that Congress has held up for months. And what have you learned from the collaboration with Governor Kasich and also other governors around the country? And what can other government leaders learn from your shared experience of fostering bipartisanship?
You bet. And I think this is a time when we need everyone to make a more concerted effort, a stronger effort towards being bipartisan. And, John Kasich and I, and we didn't know each other well until just about a year ago, and I was getting very worried about what the Trump administration, which was just coming into office, and there were a lot of threats about the Affordable Care Act being dismantled, and I felt it would be meaningful to have a Republican governor and a Democratic governor both stand side by side and say, hey, wait a second, we agree that you got to control costs, we agree that things should change, it can be improved, but we don't want to roll back coverage, and we don't want to roll back the partnership with the federal government. And Kasich is a remarkable person in his own right. We don't agree on a number of things, but finding those core values where we can find the appropriate compromises, it has been a real, I think, a powerful motivator for a lot of people in states all around the country. You know, Justice Louis Brandeis, more than a century ago, said that states are the laboratories of democracy. Mm-hmm. So we're the ones that's got to be doing the experiments and coming up with the innovations and then finding out whether they work or not. Mm-hmm. And one of the real byproducts of, you know, for the CHIP letter that we just sent out before Christmas, we had 12 bipartisan governors, governors from Louisiana and Alaska, Massachusetts and Montana, Republicans, Democrats, even the independent, and all of us unanimously agreed that CHIP should continue and be extended as is. You know, in this day and age, you get conservative Republicans like John Kasich and liberal Democrats all recognizing these are core values that we need to embrace. That's a valuable and audible message. You know, of all the things I've worked on, I can't think of anything I've gotten more feedback from in a positive way, Republicans and Democrats, than the work with Kasich.
You know, Governor, it also seems so clear that sometimes it's adversity that pulls us together or huge threats. And I think we would all agree that threat to the nation, the opioid crisis, is really unlike anything that we have seen in our lifetimes. It's an overwhelming challenge in states and in cities, areas rural and urban, just seems to know no bounds and putting just a huge strain on resources in healthcare and in public health. We're really curious how you're grappling with the opioid crisis in Colorado. Within the National Governors Association, is there a sense of a best practice emerging at the state level to address this crisis?
I chaired, along with Governor Bentley, who was from Alabama and was an MD, we chaired a committee within the National Governors Association around opioid abuse. Since then, we set up a prescription drug monitoring program in Colorado. I think it's now in about 12 states, to make sure that somebody doesn't take a prescription and go from pharmacy to pharmacy to pharmacy. In Colorado now, you can get your prescription filled, and if you take it somewhere else, the second pharmacy you deliver it to is going to see on their computer, you just had this filled an hour ago. And we're seeing in New England that now neighboring states are providing that interoperability so that pharmacies can collaborate across state lines and make sure that people aren't, they call it kiting prescriptions. There are a number of different best practices. Getting people to go through their medicine cabinets, and I'm embarrassed, you know, every time I go to a dentist and I get a crown. I'm of that age. And the person doing my dental work, they'd finish the procedure, and then he'd say, all right, here's a prescription. Call me if you still have pain after 3 days. And then he'd give me a prescription for 30 days. That's crazy. And so we started a big effort promoted heavily on TV and radio, places where people could safely get rid of their excess opioids. And now, in terms of our Medicaid patients, unless they've got continuing chronic pain, we're limiting the opioid prescriptions to 7 days. You know, I'm pushing very hard for 5 days because someone showed me a study that just 5 days of continuous opioid use for certain people, that will they will become addicted in that short of time. To what lengths are we willing to go to eliminate pain? And maybe are there other things more effective? The, you know, there's a study that came out in the American Journal of Public Health. They did a study on our, when we legalized recreational marijuana, we saw a benefit in terms of the opioid abuse. They normalized all our efforts around drug monitoring programs and reducing that kind of usage, but they still found a 6 or 7% reduction in opioid abuse from the legalization of recreational marijuana. And the moment that came in, my phone came off the hook because a lot of people who were very much opposed to recreational marijuana being legal had lots of negative things to say about the study.
Governor Hickenlooper, I know you've just mentioned the issue of Colorado legalizing marijuana a number of years ago. You were initially against it. We just saw the other day that California became another state. I think now one out of five Americans live in a state where there's legalized marijuana. You've realized some benefits and some negative concerns about the whole issue. And I'm wondering if you could just share with the larger American population what you see as the benefits or the negatives around this grand social experiment that Colorado was front and center on.
Yeah, and it certainly is a social experiment. I've been hesitant to claim victory. I think everyone has to recognize that the old system was badly broken. We sent millions of young people, young adults, to prison, in most cases for felonies, largely Latinos, African American, children of color, for nonviolent crimes. In many ways, condemning a couple of generations. As we legalize it, I'm not sure we've perfected the system yet. And we had some initial unintended consequences. We had a lot of toddlers admitted to emergency rooms. The kids had just gotten into the edibles. So we changed the law and made it so that whenever you sell edibles, it has to be in a tamper-proof container. That kind of stuff was stuff we didn't get right. You know, I went out to California and I talked to the General Assembly out there and I talked to Governor Brown, and they are learning from all the states that have gone ahead of them. And I think they're going to learn from our mistakes. They're going to create their new innovations, and we're going to try and learn from them as well. Certainly, we've seen less drug dealers. We didn't have any old existing statistics how many drug dealers are there. But people that had like day labor companies that workers would come and work for a day and get paid in cash, they describe always having two or three drug dealers around. So when these guys would get off work and have a pocket full of cash, they'd try to be selling mostly pot. Now, two specific different companies specifically said, you know, we don't see drug dealers around anymore. And we actually had to lower the taxes that we were charging to recreational marijuana to make sure that we really did push the black market so far underground that it's not worth the risk to continue operating. So I think we're getting close to getting it right.
Well, Governor Hickenlooper, you are in office until 2019 when your term limit is reached, and certainly your name is mentioned as a possible contender in the 2020 presidential race. We'd love to have you comment on the current political climate, but also I'd like to invite you to maybe share with us how your hopes and aspirations fit into this shifting political landscape.
Sure. Now, what's going on right now across the country, the divides we've seen between rural and urban America, issues around access to health care, some of the basics that this country's always really been a leader in, the investment in infrastructure, somehow all that is being turned upside down. And I think for me, my highest priority is to make sure that I have it in my little handheld calendar. It counts down every day. And that's true for all my cabinet. And our goal is to finish strong. And one of the things we've talked about repeatedly is to make Colorado not just the thinnest state, but the healthiest state by all these different metrics. I'm not sure we're going to get there, but we certainly will have moved up, you know, 5 or 10 different places, and we'll be within shouting distance of the healthiest states. I hope that as this year goes forward, people begin to temper some of the, I call them crude political approaches to making decisions. You see it mostly in Washington, but we're beginning to see it out in Colorado as well, where people will oppose something that really benefits their constituents, but they'll oppose it just because it might give political advantage to a candidate in a year and a half. It drives me crazy. We're trying to figure out how to draw new alliances where people come together not around what party are you in, but what are your core beliefs. And healthcare is an excellent example there, where pretty much everyone doesn't want to roll back coverage. Pretty much everyone believes we've got to find ways to control costs, and pretty much everyone knows they've got to continue to improve quality. I think clean air and clean water are big common values for most Americans, and a belief in public land. So we've been talking to the outdoor recreation industry about getting more politically involved, not in Republicans or Democrats, but in those basic values about cleaner air, cleaner water, access to public lands. I think those kinds of alliances that are outside the political order, I hope, are going to be the future. And as people see more examples again, you're still going to have people voting for Republicans or Democrats in elections, but it would be nice to have some really loud voices that weren't quite so strident around, about one party or the other.
We've been speaking today with Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. You can learn more about his work by going to colorado.gov, or you can follow him on Twitter at GovOfCO. Governor Hickenlooper, Happy New Year, and thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Happy New Year to you guys, and keep doing your great work.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Our roundup of whoppers from 2017 includes several items on healthcare, including many on the Republican efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. House Speaker Paul Ryan said he didn't think anyone would be hurt by an $800 billion reduction in Medicaid spending over 10 years in the healthcare bill. But at the time, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that 14 million fewer Americans would have Medicaid coverage by 2026 compared with current law. Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto wrongly claimed that, quote, over 1.2 million Nevadans with pre-existing conditions would be denied coverage or face exorbitant unaffordable premiums. The bill would not have allowed insurers to deny coverage. Also, the 1.2 million figure is a high-end estimate for all Nevadans with some pre-existing condition. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican who voted against the health care bill, said subsidies, quote, are actually greater under the Republican bill than they are under the current Obamacare law. That was wrong. CBO said the average subsidy under the bill would be significantly lower than the average subsidy under the Affordable Care Act, and the government would save $424 billion over 10 years, due mainly to reductions in government subsidies. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Tinnitus is a vexing condition that afflicts millions of Americans, a condition for which there is really no viable treatment to date, but a University of Michigan researcher may have found a solution. Lead researcher Dr. Susan Shore says tinnitus, marked by a constant ringing in the ears, is really the results of misfiring brain signals. Her team has developed a device aimed at getting to the root cause of tinnitus, neurons in the region of the brain stem called the cochlear nucleus. When those cells become hyperactive, they create a signal that is transmitted to the part of the brain where hearing perception occurs, and the constant ringing can wreak havoc on sufferers' lives.
What you're doing is you're tricking the brain into altering its circuitry to go back to normal.
The device is called a targeted bimodal auditory somatosensory stimulation and works on two fronts. It uses both weak electrical impulses targeted to the brain stem region responsible for the problem and also sends time sound to interrupt the auditory sensation caused by the tinnitus. Dr. Shore says they found it more successful with tinnitus sufferers who were able to control the condition already through certain facial movements.
We developed this treatment for a particular class of tinnitus in which the person who has the tinnitus is able to modulate either the pitch or the loudness of their tinnitus by pushing on their face or pushing on their forehead or clenching their jaw.
The study group has been relatively small so far, just a few dozen participants, but the results have been quite promising. Dr. Shore says that the severity of the tinnitus was greatly reduced in most of the participants, and some got to the point where it no longer interfered with their daily lives. She says they're hoping to enlist more participants to advance their research on preventing tinnitus symptoms symptoms from reoccurring.
We need a good solution for tinnitus, as it's affecting millions of people.
A relatively simple, targeted device that could potentially help millions of tinnitus sufferers from the worst effects of their condition, allowing them to diminish or even ignore what is often a debilitating condition for many to live with. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.